Hello, this is Randy Thompson from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to Music Review. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. For the next half hour, I shall be reading articles about music from such sources as the New York Times, the News and Observer, the Week Magazine, Rolling Stone, and Entertainment Weekly. Music Review is designed to provide the latest coverage of classical, folk, jazz, blues, rock, country, and pop music news. But first, these musical trivia questions. Our musical trivia questions come to us from the website onthisday.com. Question number one, FTD, Floris Transworld Delivery, reported back in 1977 today that the number of orders for flowers to be delivered to a specified location had surpassed the number for any other event in the company's history. By the way, FTD was founded in 1910. So what was the event that happened on this very day back in 1977 that led to this record delivery of flowers? And question number two, it was on this day back in 1962 that musician Pete Best was fired from a band managed by Brian Epstein. Who replaced him in this band? Hint, the replacement, a member of a group called Rory Storm and the Hurricanes, became a star and was known for his jewelry. So, who was he? The answers to these two important musical trivia questions will be given, as usual, at the end of today's program. Our transitions come to us from that same website, onthisday.com, and today, quote-unquote, is the weekend of August 16th. Well, it was on this day back in 1838 that 138 singing teachers traveled to Boston, Massachusetts to attend the very first music convention, 1838. And it was 80 years ago today, 1939, that The Wizard of Oz premiered in New York. Judy Garland became famous for the movie's song, Somewhere Over the Rainbow. And in country music news, we have this article entitled, Ken Burns' Country Epic. The filmmaker's 16-hour documentary is a journey into the nation's rowdy, sentimental, multicultural soul. This is written by Will Hermes and published in Rolling Stone magazine, August 2019. Ken Burns was in Dallas some years ago visiting a good friend, philanthropist Cappy McGar. The filmmaker was working on his 2012 Depression-era miniseries, The Dust Bowl, and as usual for a workaholic who often has six or seven films brewing, Burns was turning over ideas for his next project. When McGar suggested tackling country music, it just exploded in my brain, like, of course, Burns says. And as we got into it, we saw that it was as real, important, and emotionally compelling as any film we've made. Country Music, which premieres on PBS on September the 15th, is Burns' first major release since 2017's unsettling, highly acclaimed The Vietnam War, and his second deep dive into American music, following 2001's Jazz. It's scarcely less exhaustive at 16 and a half hours spread across 8 episodes, Country Music distills 101 interviews, more than 700 hours of archival clips, and 100,000 still photos into a story as complex and multifaceted as the nation it mirrors. It takes a sweepingly broad view of the genre, from so-called hillbilly songs, in truth a stew of Anglo-American folk, African-American blues, and multicultural spirituals, to western swing and bluegrass, cowboy and honky-tonk tunes, country-politan ballads, and outlaw jams. There are also detours into the styles that country music irreducibly informed: rock and roll, rockabilly, country rock, and Americana. Country fans will be gobsmacked, and those who think they have no interest in the genre will have to think again. Country music might well be the most ambitious, culturally resonant music documentary ever made. As the series notes, all four Beatles were country fans, so was Charlie Parker. Figures outside the country ecosystem, Jack White, Paul Simon, Wynton Marsalis, supply perspective, along with an ensemble, and estimatable historian, Bill Malone, author of the recently updated 1968 cornerstone, Country Music USA. But mostly the story is told by the music's own stars and side people, many of whom are passionate historians themselves. We went to assuming we have a more substantial representation from experts and from outside of country, says Burns. We didn't need them. The country people know their story really, really well. That story begins with the music's so-called Big Bang, the Carter family, and Jimmy Rogers recording at the legendary Bristol Sessions in Tennessee in 1927. Their stories weave through the series, part via the Carter Cash dynasty, beginning when Johnny Cash falls in love with June Carter, part via Rogers' acolyte Merle Haggard, whose own life intersects with Cash's when Haggard sees him perform at San Quentin State Prison while Haggard is an inmate there. That was a life-changing encounter, spurring Hagger onto a path to become one of America's greatest songwriters, and his account of it is one of the series' many wrenching moments. Roseanne Cash was also among the first artists Burns and his team approached. She had initial reservations about how the music story would be presented. Cash was also among the first to see the finished film. They connected every dot, she says, from Appalachia to Bob Wills to Bakersfield to my dad. It was artfully done and so moving. It's really important people know country music is a hybrid, a creolization that comes out of African and European cultures mixing, says singer Rihanna Giddens, an early American music scholar who drove that point home earlier this year on a concert program with Burns, Marsalis, Stewart, and the Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra. Also, most importantly, it comes from working-class people mixing. That's the thing that's often forgotten. That, where people made these interactions musically, was in the fields, on the riverboats, or wherever, and that this music is our music, all of us together. It's very dangerous to subscribe to it as white music or as this monolithic thing, because it's not. And that's the beauty of America, I think. All the positive stuff comes out of that aspect of the mix. The series Coda is a slideshow of modern artists, Taylor Swift, Little Big Town, Stargell Simpson, and others, but it effectively ends in the 90s, Johnny Cash's death notwithstanding. Those who want framing on the Dixie Chicks' mid-2000s blacklisting, the gender politics of modern country radio, or the cultural ramifications of Old Town Road may be frustrated. I don't expect this to affect contemporary country music radio, but I do believe it will bring awareness and understanding about where country music comes from and how deep it goes. And I think for any culturally minded contemporary country singer or songwriter, a star or a would-be, it will help them understand what they're really a part of. This is a history of an art form whose roots are dark and complex and part of our collective unconscious, says Cash, rooted in our migration and history and who we became as Americans. It's all there in this story, all these songs that came from Scotland and England and Ireland into Appalachia, and the slave songs and work songs that came from Africa. The melding of that, that's our history. And it's important to know your history. What are some of the key tracks from this series? Well, there's Jimmy Rogers, Blue Yodel Number 8, that's the Mule Skinner Blues, The Carter Family, Can the Circle Be Unbroken, Patsy Cline, Crazy, Kris Kristofferson, Me and Bobby McGee, and Dolly Parton, I Will Always Love You.
Waking skies at sunrise, every sunset too.
Dr. John with Arturo Sandoval on trumpet playing Memories of You introduces our jazz music news. As noted by Andy Green and David Brown in Rolling Stone magazine on June 6, 2019, towards the break of day on June 6, 2019, iconic music legend Malcolm John Reibenach Jr., professionally known as Dr. John, passed away of a heart attack. As a Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductee, six-time Grammy winner, songwriter, composer, producer, and performer, he created a unique blend of music which carried his hometown, New Orleans, at its heart, as it was always in his heart. Born Malcolm John Reibenach on November 21, 1940, Dr. John was immersed in the music of his native city from an early age. He started banging on a piano when he was 3 and venturing to African American clubs when he was a teenager. His first instrument was the guitar, not the piano, and he soon met and began playing with Professor Longhair, the New Orleans piano icon. His life and music took a fateful turn when, in 1960, he broke up a fight and his left index finger was hit by a bullet. With that, he switched to piano, which would be his primary instrument throughout his career. When the New Orleans music scene gave way to Detroit's Motown world, Dr. John relocated to Los Angeles in 1964, where he began his session man career as a key part of the Wrecking Crew, stable of ace Los Angeles session musicians in the 60s. He played on recordings by Cher, Aretha Franklin, Canned Heat, Frank Zappa, and countless others, fusing funk with R&B and boogie-woogie. Originally, he'd planned for another musician to play the Dr. John character, modeled after a voodoo priest, but when that player opted out, Reibenach took over the part himself, signing with Atlantic by way of legendary producer Jerry Wexler. Dr. John found his groove and his voice, starting with Gumbo, the landmark 1972 album that featured his renditions of Ico Ico, Let the Good Times Roll, and other New Orleans classics. The next year, he hit his commercial peak when his funky stomp, Right Place, Wrong Time, hit the top 10. Those albums showcased not only his loose growl and rhythmic sense, but his piano playing, which incorporated boogie and swinging syncopation. Reibenach summed up his career back in 1973 when he told Rolling Stone that audiences don't need to know anything about New Orleans or voodoo to enjoy his music. If you're going to get off on something, you don't need to know nothing about it. Music is a universal language, he said. If it's opera in Italian, you ain't supposed to know nothing about Italy. You can just sit there and dig on it.
Memories of you.
And in music research and technology, we have this article, and it's published in thestage.co.uk by Susan Elkin on August the 6th, 2019, entitled, How Learning a Musical Instrument Can Boost Your Acting Career. Being able to play a musical instrument can increase your chances of getting acting jobs. Actor musicians have never been in more demand. So how do you embrace this trend if you didn't train as an actor musician, have never played a musical instrument, or haven't done for a very long time? One way is to learn from someone you're working with who can already do it. Yolanda Brown, 36, self-taught saxophonist of CBeebies and concert fame, learned the saxophone after failing to warm to violin and piano. Having been given an instrument for Christmas in my early teens, I worked out the basics over the holiday and took it from there, she says. Jonathan Ashby Rock, 29, actor and artistic director at Hounslow Arts Center, believes in never saying no to anything. I played guitar in all styles with a fine and eclectic teacher when I was a teenager. But when I started auditioning, there were too many guitarists about. Then what he calls youthful ballsiness got him a job in Of Mice and Men at the Broccoli Jack. They wanted harmonica, and I blithely said that I could do it, he recalls, chuckling. On the way home, I went and brought a box of harmonicas and learned in a week. I've also taught myself banjo and mandolin. So where does that leave the ukulele? So simple to master in the very early stages that it is now used extensively in primary schools instead of the traditional recorder. We've sometimes had to say, no ukuleles when we're auditioning at Hounslow, says Ashby Rock, because there are too many people who can play five chords. That's tiresome for an actor-performer such as Amanda Harkett, 33, who originally trained in musical theater and then as an opera singer because she's a serious ukulele player. I've done flute in various recorders at school and first picked up the ukulele as a joke. Then I found it was really liberating to be able to accompany myself in opera arias, so I worked at it and eventually developed a show called Operella, which has toured extensively in Britain and Europe. Once you've decided to push yourself on an instrument, one of the best ways of practicing is to join a local amateur band or orchestra. Most of these are desperate for players of certain instruments, especially strings, brass, and percussion, even at very elementary levels. Flutes and clarinets tend to be plentiful, so bear this in mind if you're trying to work out which instrument to hone your skills on. And don't worry if the orchestra is playing Mozart, but you really want to do musical theater. The Western classical tradition provides an excellent base for any sort of further development. Or maybe you're looking for lessons and courses. There's a huge range of summer schools where you can learn musical instruments. For example, short courses in music performance, songwriting, and music production are available. Benslow Music in Hertfordshire runs short residential musical instrument courses across all genres and caters for all abilities, from folk fiddling by ear, summer saxophone classes and gospel choirs, to learning to sight sing, string and quartets, and late starter violin lessons. And as soon as you tap into any of these networks, you meet other people keen to develop their skills with whom you can practice from groups and create work. We've all seen plays employ actor-musician talents, but does it also work for full-blown musical theater? It depends on the instrument, says Harris. Instruments that you can play while singing and dancing are good, as in the recent sung-through production of The Curious Case of Benjamin Button. You can't sing and blow at the same time. Ashby Rock hires performers as well as acting and playing instruments himself. He says, turn nothing down. Be open to small roles and be prepared to learn new skills, such as playing an instrument.
Don't make it bad. Take a sad song.
make it better. Hey Jude, don't be afraid.
The Beatles' Hey Jude introduces our rock and pop music news. It's an article entitled The Stories Behind the Songs. Meet the real people who inspired some of pop music's biggest hits, from It Ain't Me, Babe to Sweet Caroline. This is written by Jim Farber, published in Parade Magazine, 8/11/19. Do you know who Carly Simon was anticipating? Who inspired Dear Prudence? How about the stories behind such classics as Rosanna and Philadelphia Freedom? While some stars want their songs to be universally relatable and avoid leaving clues about a song's origins, others are less subtle. We put on our Sherlock Holmes hats to figure out the people and stories behind some of the pop's biggest hits. Go to parade.com/songs for 30 and more songs. The Beatles, And I Love Her, Yesterday, and I'm Looking Through You. All three of these were performed and penned by Paul McCartney for model Jane Asher, whom he dated in the mid-60s. Then there's Dear Prudence. The Dear Prudence Won't You Come Out to Play, Dear Prudence, Greet the Brand New Day of the song is Prudence Farrow, now Bruins, the daughter of film director John Farrow and actress Maureen O'Sullivan, and younger sister of actress Mia Farrow. It was at the Marisha Yogi's retreat in 1968 when Prudence's fellow students, including the Beatles, that her behavior led John Lennon to write the song, which appears on the Beatles' White Album. And finally, there's Hey Jude by the Beatles. Feeling paternal, McCartney wrote this song of comfort for John Lennon's son, Julian, who was then just 5, after his father divorced his mother, Cynthia. The song, released as a non-album single in 1968, was the first release on the Beatles' new Apple label. Finally, in local music news, we have this article simply titled, Lineups. IBMA's 2019's Wide Open Bluegrass Festival in Raleigh, September 27th through the 28th. This is published in pinecone.org on the 7th of August, 2019. Performances at Red Hat Amphitheater will begin at 5 p.m. each night and will feature premier bluegrass acts for 6 hours. This year's lineup includes Sam Bush as a special guest of the Del McCurry Band, the debut of bluegrass supergroup The Ringers, featuring Jerry Douglas, Ronnie McCurry, Todd Phillips, Christian Sedemeyer, and Dan Tyminski, and a special performance, You Gave Me a Song, celebrating the music of Hazel Dickens and Alice Gerard. They Joan previously announced Sarah Watkins, Sarah Jarosz, and Auf O'Donovan, Doyle Lawson and Quicksilver, Molly Tuttle, Balsam Range, Sister Sadie, and Frank Sullivan and Dirty Kitchen. Rumor has it that these events are for the first time free this year at the Red Hat Amphitheater for the Wide Open Bluegrass Festival in Raleigh, IBMA 2019. So how'd you do on today's musical trivia questions? Well, the answer to our first question, it was 42 years ago today that Elvis Presley died of coronary arrhythmia at the age of 42 in Memphis, Tennessee. FTD reported that orders for flowers to Graceland surpassed the number of flowers ordered for any other event in FTD history. FTD was founded in 1910, by the way. As noted in ClassicBands.com, Presley's girlfriend, Ginger Alden, awoke in the afternoon and noticed that he was not in bed, found him lying on the floor of the bathroom. Efforts to resuscitate him were unsuccessful, and at 3:30 p.m. he was pronounced dead. After an examination, it was revealed that Presley's body contained butabarbital, codeine, morphine, pentobarbital, placidil, Quaalude, Valium, and Valmed. It had been 5 years since the King had a U.S. top 10 hit with the number 2 song, Burning Love. His last U.S. number one was 1969's Suspicious Minds. He left an estate valued at $4.9 million, which by 1993 had grown to over $50 million. In his last conversation with Ginger Alden, he told her, "I'm going to the bathroom to read." When she cautioned him not to fall asleep in there, his final words were, "Okay, I won't." And the answer to our second question, it was on this day back in 1962 that musician Pete Best was fired from a band managed by Brian Epstein. Who replaced him in this band? And I gave as a hint that the replacement, a member of a group called Rory Storm and the Hurricanes, became a star and was known for his jewelry. So, who was he? And the correct answer, Ringo Starr. As noted in ClassicBands.com, 2 years and 4 days after joining, Pete Best was fired from the Beatles by manager Brian Epstein and was told by record producer George Martin that he wanted to use a more experienced session drummer on the band's recordings. John, Paul, and George had long admired the work of Rory Storm and the Hurricanes drummer Ringo Starr, who jumped at the chance to join them. After his dismissal, Pete Best would never have any further communication with his former mates, although they did pass each other in a hallway when Pete's new band, Lee Curtis and the All-Stars, played the Tower in New Brighton the same night as the Beatles. Neither one spoke or made eye contact. So let's close out today's program with a little help from Ringo's friends at the beach. Octopus's Garden. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Music Review. And as we leave you, remember these words. Kindness is a language which blind people see and deaf people hear. Be sure to tune in at the same time next week. I'm Randy Thompson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Music Review, readily available as a podcast after the broadcast in our website, ncreadingservice.org. Now, if you have a suggestion for music to feature on this program, please leave a message for me, Randy Thompson, 919-832-5138. So long, until next time.